Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rosemary Main, and at 1400 GMT on Wednesday, the 1st of January, these are our main stories. Tens of thousands of pro-democracy campaigners hold the first protest of the year in Hong Kong. A powerful Iranian-backed militia in Iraq has ordered its supporters to withdraw from the US embassy in Baghdad. And in Australia, the new year sees bushfires claiming more lives and property. Also in this podcast, the mum of a British woman convicted for lying about being raped backs calls for tourists to boycott Cyprus.
If you go and report something that's happened to you, you're either laughed at, as far as I can tell, or in the worst case, something like what's happened to my daughter may happen.
We begin this podcast in Hong Kong, where 2020 is continuing in much the same way as 2019 ended. Thousands of people on the streets demanding greater democracy and more autonomy from Chinese control. Jimmy Sham is the leader of the Civil Rights Front.
From the beginning of the movement until now, we can see the government is trying to suppress us all. The teachers and maybe next civil servants and members of the district council. No matter who is being pressured, I want them to know that we will stand with them, not forgetting what we were fighting for.
Our correspondent Jonathan Head was at the New Year protest in Hong Kong.
We've been walking through the main road that goes through Wan Chai district, where there was a very large rally with, it's hard to guess the numbers, but certainly I would say many thousands of people filling out the streets this afternoon. Now we're at the end of that in the evening, and the police have spent the last hour clearing the remnants off the streets. Towards the end of the protest, some hardcore protesters came in and have formed a few barricades. You can see in front of me, you can hear the police shouting at the moment, trying to get people out. They're questioning, actually checking all of our identities. They brought a water cannon down as well, and they are clearing everyone off these streets. They basically said they allowed the protest to take place, but now they're saying that any gathering is illegal. They want everyone off the streets. There haven't really been any significant confrontations, but at the moment the police don't want any of us around. In fact, they're pushing us back as well. They've just taken, just seen them take a young man in front of me, and they're checking his identity. So it's, you know, it's another day in Hong Kong. The people who organised the rally wanted to make it clear that they've grabbed another guy here too. They think these people are protesters. They wanted to make it clear that they still had mass support, and I think they did that with the numbers who came out. The police are also making it clear that they will only allow a certain amount of protest, and beyond that, they want everyone off these streets now. Normally, this is a very busy part of Hong Kong. At the moment, we've got police vehicles everywhere, a lot of quite agitated police officers, and really, most of the protesters now appear to have dispersed.
Jonathan, is there any sign that either side is willing or able to compromise? Because it's been more than 6 months since these protests began.
The concept of compromise is quite difficult because If you listen to the five demands that these protesters talk about, in many ways they're symbolic. And one's already been met anyway. The extradition bill that sparked these off was withdrawn. There's a much broader sense among the protest movement of their concerns about encroachment on Hong Kong's autonomy and the erosion of its identity. And I feel a lot of protesters, they just want to keep on protesting. They don't feel there's any answer to this. The government also is backed by Beijing, doesn't appear to want to give any impression of giving concessions. So we are locked in this tremendous battle of wills. And even 7 months on, there really is no sign of either side shifting.
The United Nations was founded 75 years ago this year and has planned a year of events to commemorate the milestone anniversary. But with nationalism on the rise and the US pursuing an America-first approach to diplomacy, what are the challenges the UN faces now? This report from Nick Bryant at UN headquarters in New York.
They came to design, together, machinery to end war, a curse which in 30 years had killed 40 million human beings.
1945. And as the guns of war in Europe and Asia finally fell silent, countries came together to create the United Nations, the institutional bedrock of a new rules-based international order.
The representatives of 2,000 million people pledged to promote freedom from fear and freedom of expression, freedom from want and freedom of worship.
The UN was not created to take mankind to heaven, but to save humanity from hell. The words of Doug Hammarskjöld, the organization's most beloved Secretary General, have come to serve as a mission statement of sorts. And in the context of its founding year, that meant saving the world from another global conflict. But what now, 75 years on?
Let's look out here. We can see all the flags lined up of all of the member states. They're lined up from A to Z.
When tour groups are shown around its headquarters in Manhattan, they're probably unaware of the breadth of UN activities. It's disaster relief, it's 13 peacekeeping missions, it's work in eradicating diseases such as smallpox and polio. With its unique convening power, the UN still offers the biggest stage in international diplomacy.
People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing.
Here it was used by the teenage activist Greta Thunberg during a climate summit in New York to shame world leaders. But Richard Gowan of the International Crisis Group fears its global impact is diminishing, partly because of the paralysis on the Security Council, partly because it's been slow to respond to modern-day issues, such as the impact of disruptive technologies.
The UN has a long, proud history of work on issues like international development, but it's not clear that it's got the right mechanisms to deal with 21st century questions like artificial intelligence or cybersecurity. So it is going through a bit of an existential rethink, if not a crisis.
Dame Karen Pearce is the UK's permanent representative to the UN.
I'd say it was in transition mode. But it badly needs to up its game and to modernise. It has, it's never had the period of reform that most national governments have had over successive decades. And it's now 75 years old.
Often the UN doesn't solve the world's problems, but merely reflects them. It's the sum of its antagonistic parts, the member states themselves. And that's as true now as it was in the year of its foundation.
This charter points the way, but whether the world is to move in that direction will depend finally upon the vigilance and sovereign will of the peoples of the world.
Nick Bryant on the 75th anniversary of the UN. North Korea's state media is reporting the country's leader Kim Jong-un is saying that Pyongyang will no longer hold to a moratorium on nuclear and long-range missile tests. Mr. Kim also said his country would soon introduce a new strategic weapon. The moratorium had been central to a less hostile relationship with the United States. Jonathan Marcus, our defence and diplomatic correspondent, has been following developments.
Clearly, there are grounds to believe that tensions on the Korean Peninsula between the United States and North Korea are likely to grow. It's interesting that the North Korean leadership hasn't simply gone ahead and carried out an intercontinental ballistic missile test or indeed a nuclear test of some kind. You could look on the bright side and say that he is leaving a glimmer of space open to get some kind of response from the Americans. But of course, what response can there be? The United States and Pyongyang are on completely different tacks, despite all the talk of bromance and love affairs on Mr. Trump's part with the North Korean leader. The basic fact is that they define denuclearization in two totally different ways. And as long as that rift persists, I think we are on a growing path, if you like, of escalating tension. And the difficulty now, of course, is that if the North Koreans do go ahead with an intercontinental ballistic missile test or whatever, how is the United States going to respond? And does it have the allies in place, and particularly the relationship with Beijing, which is also not good at the moment, which will enable it to bring some countervailing pressure to bear on Pyongyang? So it is a very difficult and uncertain situation.
The tiny Pacific nation of Palau has become the first country to enforce a ban on sun cream that's harmful to corals and marine life. From today, products containing 10 common ingredients cannot be sold or worn in the country. Steve Jackson reports.
Palau in the Western Pacific is a nation of hundreds of small islands and markets itself as a paradise for divers. But in recent years, there's been growing evidence that chemicals from sunscreen are harming marine life. Some of these substances are particularly damaging to young fish species, threatening their growth. The ban includes organic compounds such as oxybenzone that absorb ultraviolet light. Although Palau is the first, several other countries and regions have announced plans to ban these pollutants, which are found in about half of all sun creams.
As part of our series on songs which captured a moment in 2019, today we go to South Africa, which saw a wave of protests in August and September. The protesters were mainly women, and they took to the streets to denounce what they called the scourge of femicide. On average, a woman is killed every 3 hours in South Africa. But when a 19-year-old student at the University of Cape Town, Uyanini Mwana, was raped and murdered by an employee at the local post office, activists declared enough was enough. Pumza Fulani has been speaking to one of her friends about their friendship and about the old apartheid struggle song which was sung at the vigils held to commemorate her life.
A song of sorrow, a mournful prayer. Senzeni na, meaning what have we done? Once the sound of rebellion against racial apartheid. In 2019, the sound of grief at the death of a young woman. The nation rose up for Uyinene Mrwetyana, a 19-year-old University of Cape Town student, raped and murdered when she went to collect a parcel from the post office.
It was absolutely surreal. Her face was on posters and people would shout her name.
Sinotile Norman was a childhood friend of Uyinene.
Women were protesting about women's rights, against femicide, about women not being safe, all of those things. But it was surreal to me because it had sparked because of my friend.
This is for Uyinene. It's for all the women who have died and been raped by the violence in this country. It's enough.
As a 19-year-old student, I am Uyinene, and I'm angry. I'm tired.
Enough is enough!
Uyinene's brutal death led to nationwide protests. Thousands of women carrying placards marched in the main cities. And night vigils were held at universities across the country. Senzeni Na could be heard again and again. The traditional version of the song asks, what have we, the black population, done to deserve our fate? For Uyinene, the students changed the words.
When I heard the song at the night vigil and they changed the words from our sin is being black to Isono Setu Kukuba Ngumfazi, which means our sin is to be a woman, I kept thinking, is this really happening? I had to hear it again. It was a very difficult thing. So it went from hearing the songs and seeing those night vigils, then to me just trying to take out whatever that's positive from the situation and just trying to think about what she would think about the whole movement, because she was a feminist and she was someone who was very vocal about women's rights. It's unfair. She was only 19 and she died when she had so much more to do. She was going to do something really influential in a positive way and she didn't get to do that. She didn't get to finish her degree. She didn't get to see her second year. She didn't get to see Christmas. She didn't get to see her 20th birthday. She didn't get to see a lot of those things because of one man's conscious decision.
Sinotile Norman, ending that report by Pumza Fulani. Still to come in this podcast, a call for the 2020s to be a decade of reconnecting with people.
In a kind of way, taking a beat, taking a second to just think about the person in front of you and smiling and saying hello.
It's been a bleak beginning to the new decade in Australia. Fires are still raging across vast areas and there's no let up in sight. Officials say 8 people were killed on Tuesday, the highest number since the start of the fire season back in September. And the authorities are struggling to reach many remote areas. Luke Hegarty is an official overseeing the response in Victoria, one of the worst affected states.
Realistically, these fires are of such a size now that we wouldn't expect to be able to control them without significant rainfall. To give you an idea of the size just of the fires in Gippsland, they're almost 600,000 hectares now, and a hectare is roughly your average sports field. So it's a huge area of fire that we're dealing with.
Our correspondent Phil Mercer is following developments from Sydney. So what more is known about the circumstances of the latest deaths?
Well, we know that 7 people have been found dead here in New South Wales and another man in the state of Victoria. And it would seem that these victims were either trying to defend their properties against these large bushfires when they died, or they were trying to escape the flames when they were killed, because the victims were found either near properties, near homes, or in cars or burnt out cars. And the authorities are warning that this grim toll is almost certainly expected to rise, because all of the devastated areas have yet to be examined. There has been so much devastation. These bushfires have torn through such large areas. It could well be a few days before the extent of these particular fires is known, but the effect has been terrible, really. These bushfires, devastating and deadly.
Can you explain what sort of difficulties the emergency services are having getting to help the most remote communities?
Fires, they're still burning. They are, the authorities, very aware that they will only send these recovery or assessment teams into areas that are safe. And there are so many areas that are clearly not safe. When we think of the town of Mallacoota, for example, in Victoria, this is a seaside community about 500 kilometres to the east of Melbourne. Thousands of people are still stranded there because the roads are still impassable. They are still too dangerous to travel on. So you have thousands of holidaymakers and residents relying on emergency supplies that came in today on 3 police boats. They brought food, water and medical supplies. In the last few hours, a Navy ship left its base here in Sydney to travel down to that particular region at the request of the Victorian state government. So the military is being involved. Army helicopters are flying down to affected areas too. So I think it's safe to say that Australia does feel like a country on a war footing. The military is involved, and we are expecting conditions certainly over the weekend to get as bad as they were on Tuesday, or if not worse.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. In the state of Victoria, some communities in active fire zones were out of contact. Supplies were reportedly dwindling in Mallacoota, where residents had sought refuge on the beach as fires closed in. Mariska Astcher, a resident of Mallacoota, told Dan Damon more about the rescue effort.
We have seen the boat just off the shores of Mallacoota. They've been extremely helpful, also sending helicopters to pick up some of the stranded tourists that came in by bus or whatever, without their cars. It's been quite hectic here, and we've had a lot of help from the volunteer firefighters. We are really remote here, and it's all bushland. So when you leave Mallacoota, it's all bush either way. So a lot of people stayed in Mallacoota because of the fact that we don't know where the embers are going to go. We don't know whether it's going to happen from one town to another. So it was safer to really stay here in Mallacoota, which majority of people have done.
And what are the conditions now? Are there embers still falling?
Yes, there are. There are embers still falling. In fact, in Mallacoota, there is a beautiful lake system, which is nearly as big as Sydney Harbour Bridge. And across the lake system from us is the Howe Range, which is absolutely beautiful. It's a national park, and it is on fire now. It started yesterday, and this morning it's quite large. Mostly a cool fire where the undergrowth has been burning, but there are problems with the fire continuing into the higher areas of the trees.
So what about yourself? What about where you are? Are you safe?
Yes, we are safe. We're halfway between Carbathon and Mallacoota, which is only a 4 kilometre distance. And where we live, it's in the middle of that, which is more of a newer state with only shrubs, no trees whatsoever. But in the township of Mallacoota and Carbathon, it's quite heavily treed. So basically the embers just fall on the dried eucalypt leaves and just explode. We've noticed that several weeks ago that there was a lot of dried eucalyptus leaves just laying on the ground. We haven't had rain for such a long time.
Mariska Astcher from Mallacoota. Earlier this week, we reported on the case of a 19-year-old British woman who was found guilty in Cyprus for lying about being raped by a group of Israeli men. She was convicted of causing public mischief after she withdrew a claim that the rape had taken place. She says she was forced to do this by the Cypriot police, an allegation they've denied. Now the woman's mother has spoken to the BBC about what her daughter plans to do next. She's given an interview to my colleague Martha Carney. Her words are spoken here by a BBC producer in order to protect her identity and that of her daughter.
We'll definitely be appealing the decision without question. The next step is that it needs to go to the Supreme Court in Cyprus. Unfortunately, there's quite a long waiting list, so our lawyers are looking at what can be done to expedite that. And that's something maybe the Foreign Office could help us with, so to get that done as soon as we can. And if that doesn't provide justice, then we'll go to the European Court of Human Rights. But again, you know, that's 4 to 8 years we'll have to wait. While that, I believe, will definitely serve justice, it's fundamentally life-changing to deal with this between 4 to 8 years. The impact on life is quite phenomenal.
What about the idea of public pressure? I mean, you've managed to get some of the costs for this crowdfunded, and there is now an online campaign to boycott tourism in Cyprus.
Do you know what? The GoFundMe, I'm absolutely astounded at the levels of support we've seen from that. I can't even describe to you the hopelessness I felt when all of this initially happened. And I thought, a big court case, how do I fund that? It's absolutely unreal. It's not just the financial support, it's the comments. They're absolutely motivating and inspiring to keep us going day in, day out. Unfortunately, we're going to have to increase the target in a little bit to help with the appeal process. I'm not totally sure what the figure needs to be to do that yet, but we will be doing that.
And what do you think about the people who are calling for a tourism boycott of Cyprus?
My personal view is that's a good thing to do. Because from what I've seen, and it's not just my daughter's case, just looking at TripAdvisor from the hotel that she was staying at, there are other reports of people breaking into rooms and attempted rapes. That's just one hotel over one summer season. There's hundreds of hotels in Ayia Napa. This is not an isolated incident. The place isn't safe. It's absolutely not safe. And if you go and report something that's happened to you, you're either laughed at, as far as I can tell, or in the worst case, something like what's happened to my daughter may happen.
And how is your daughter now?
She's suffering from PTSD. She spends a lot of time with hypersomnia at the moment. That means she's sleeping an awful lot of the day. She sleeps probably 18, 20 hours a day. She's also quite withdrawn, which is very sad for me to see. And she also experiences hallucinations. And she needs to get back to the UK to get that treated. That's my absolute primary focus. She can't be treated here, because hearing foreign men speaking loudly will trigger an episode. And obviously 50% of the people who are going to be talking a foreign language are men. So it's really, really difficult for her. And she's doing very well to sort of contain that and control it at the moment. But it needs resolving. Otherwise, she's going to carry on having this for the rest of her life.
The mother of the British teenager convicted for lying about a gang rape in Cyprus, talking there to Martha Carney. A powerful Iranian-backed militia in Iraq has called for its supporters to withdraw from outside the US embassy in Baghdad, where they've set up tents as part of a protest against US airstrikes at the weekend. More than 20 members of the paramilitary force were killed in Sunday's raids, which Washington said were in response to a series of rocket attacks on US military targets in the region. Our Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher reports.
The appeal from the Popular Mobilisation Forces came as thousands of Iranian-backed militia supporters had appeared ready to set up a siege right outside the US compound, bringing tents and provisions. If the call is heeded, a new and dangerous confrontation between Iran and the US may be averted for now, but the shadow conflict between the two countries won't have diminished. In the past few months, US officials have warned repeatedly of Iran's willingness to hit American targets through its regional proxies. The US struck back at the weekend with its airstrikes on what it sees as one of those hostile forces in Iraq. President Trump and Iran's top leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei have been trading accusations, but still insist they're not seeking war.
Pope Francis has apologised after he was filmed slapping the hand of an admirer at St Peter's Square in Rome. He had been greeting pilgrims who had gathered for New Year's Eve and lost patience with one woman who appeared to tug his arm quite forcefully. Elsa Ochtney reports.
The Pope was greeting children and pilgrims in St Peter's Square and was just turning away when a woman in the crowd grabbed his hand and pulled him towards her, almost causing him to fall over. The Pope managed to break free, slapping the woman's hand twice. He later confessed to having lost patience. The papal slap provoked an avalanche of comment on Twitter, most in support of the Pope's instinctive reaction. Earlier in his first message of the new year in St Peter's Basilica, Pope Francis had denounced all violence against women.
How's this for a New Year's resolution? Call someone you've drifted apart from. That's the message from the spiritual head of the Church of England, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. He's called for a heroic New Year's resolution to mend broken relationships. Pick one person, he says, pick up the phone, send them a text. His message is echoed in an open letter by leaders of prominent British organisations who say the 2020s should be a decade of reconnection. One of those who signed that letter is Kwame Kweyama, the artistic director of London's Young Vic Theatre. Dan Damon asked him why we need to reconnect.
The things that I speak to myself about and I question myself is how isolated am I becoming within my social media echo chamber? How isolated am I becoming within the kind of oppression of my work schedule and not being able to reach out and listen to other people? How isolated am I becoming as an executive? And so in a kind of way, my challenges to myself are to always be in multiple cars at the same time, to always be hearing many voices. And hopefully if I listen to those voices, I'll be able to try and discern the thing that is most positive and act on that.
But you're so busy, and we're all so busy, aren't we? Do we have time to be nice to each other?
I think we absolutely do. And of course, I don't want to be all philosophical again about it. But first of all, it begins with ourselves, right? It begins with going, I'm really busy today. And maybe I'm working a bit too hard. And actually, maybe I snapped that reply rather than just kind of thought about it for a second. We are really busy. We're all under the kind of cosh of trying to keep up with the Joneses. But in a kind of way, taking a beat, taking a second to just think about the person in front of you or the person you don't even know that's in front of you and smiling and saying hello. It sounds really bland and really kind of surface, but I think these things are fundamental.
Kwame Kweyama, the artistic director of London's Young Vic Theatre, speaking there to Dan Damon. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Rosemary Mayne. Until next time, goodbye.